So today I'd really like to finish up discussing about eyes. We've spent more than enough time on this subject, and I don't really have that much more to cover. I had left off talking about the fact that there was a dye called rhodopsin in the rods in your eyes. These are responsible for color vision. And as such, we were talking about the fact that this is a fairly sensitive thing, so you can see you can see black and white at night much, much better than you can see colors. And I think we also talked about the fact that eyes are retroreflectors, which is the reason why eyes glow red in the flash photograph and animal eyes glow as well. So what I'd like to talk about today is something about color vision. Not too much about color vision, but there's a few important things that we should cover. And one of them is that physicists and people, I'm not saying the physicists aren't people, but physicists and people have different versions of what they mean by colors. What I have over here is white light being broken up by a prism into the spectrum. You've all seen this sort of thing before. And in this case, this, you know, works by the fact that the index of refraction of the glass is a function of the wavelength. These are spectral colors. And what I mean by that is that the wavelength of these colors are quite different. So here, the red color has a wavelength of about 400 nanometers, up into this blue-purple over here is about 700 nanometers or something like that. And all wavelengths in between can be found here. There's a continuous set of wavelengths. Yet, the way we see colors doesn't work that way. It's not sensitive to a continuous set of colors. And that's because, as I'm sure you've all seen, you can take different colors and add them together and get all of the colors in between. For instance, I have a red dot over here and a green dot there. I can turn off some of these other things. So, no, that's not the one. I can turn that off and I can turn this on and off. And when you take green light and red light and add them together, what do you get? You get yellow light, okay? And this is a little bit strange, because while that looks yellow to us, I started out with light that had a specific wavelength, say 700 nanometers, and maybe that has 5,000 nanometers. 700 nanometers, and that maybe has 500 nanometers. So how did I get light just by adding them together that's got a wavelength in between of, say, 600 nanometers, as I do with the spectral to get yellow light? And the answer is that you don't. There is no spectral yellow over there. There's nothing that has the same yellow. If I was to measure the wavelength of the stuff reflecting out of that yellow region, it doesn't have anything to do, any wavelength that would look that I would pick up for the yellow light when I did it with the prism. So our vision has to be more complicated. Something else must be going on here. And what's going on is that our eyes, have three different types of light-sensitive cells in them. And those three, there's not one type of cone, there's three different types of cones in your eyes. And they each have different spectral responses. And I forgot to ask for my computer display today, so I'll just have to draw this out from memory. But if I draw an axis in which the horizontal line over here is colors, so this is, say, red out here at 700 nanometers, and this is, say, blue somewhere over here at 400 nanometers. By the way, the reason why I keep on confusing 700 and 7,000 is I'm more used to thinking about colors in angstroms, which is a unit you're not allowed to publicly mention anymore. An angstrom is a tenth of a nanometer, so I just automatically add an extra factor of 10 until I correct myself. But never mind that. There are three types of cone cells, and these three types of cone cells are sensitive to somewhat different types of light. So that the red cells are sensitive to light that's, say, like this. That's so what do I mean by that? If you send in some light that's got one of these wavelengths, then you'll get some response out of that triggers off a nerve cell. And the higher this peak, the more response you're going to get on that nerve cell. But if you're over here, you won't get very much response at all. And then there are some other cells which do something like this. And there's actually quite an overlap between them. So typically what we say is that this would be the one that we would call the red cone, and this would be, say, the one we would call the cone responsible for green. And then there's a blue cone, something that's more sensitive to blue, and I think this actually has a double bump in it. So I think it looks something like that. And so when we send in some light, that light triggers off these cone cells, all right? Now, if we send in pure spectral light, say we send in some light which is, say, yellow over here, then what we're doing is we're sending in light that has this particular wavelength, and what it will do is it will partially trigger these red cones because the red cone overlaps into the region where the light is coming in, but it will also partially trigger off the green cone, like that. And that's what the response is to a spectral color. Now, when we have a combined color, like over here, well, you're sending in some amount of red and you're sending in some amount of green. So both of these nerve cells, the nerve cells associated with both of these things are firing. And that's exactly the same as if you were actually sending in light that had just one wavelength that figured out that was in between. So that's the explanation, such as it is, for why additive colors work. This is obviously very important technologically because, as I'm sure you know, your computer screen has only three colors in it. And all the colors in between are made by adding together various different quantities of those three colors. When you paint, a similar thing happens. When you use light to go onto a screen like over here or on a computer screen, this is called additive color. When you paint, it's called subtractive color because you're absorbing wavelengths of color. And sometimes there are three primary colors, but you may know that, for instance, on inkjet printers, if they've got a fourth color, the color looks a little bit better. So depending on how much money you want to spend on your printer, you can get a little bit more complicated schemes. But the basic scheme is the same. Any questions about that? Okay. Well, now I want to tell you that life is actually quite a bit more complicated than actually. I brought these along just for fun. I'm sure you've all seen them. These are color blindness tests. So everybody see the 12 that's here. If you're color blind, what that means is that one of your sets of cones doesn't work, and you've probably all been tested with this at one point or another, where there are patterns that look like this, and somebody will show them to you. And if you can't see the number, that means you're partially colorblind. Some of these in this book are actually quite hard. I suspect you guys cannot see those numbers from a distance. Or maybe you can, I don't know. Yeah, I can kind of make them out when I look at them closely, but these are hard. Okay, but even if you assume all of that's true, the phenomenon of color is actually quite a bit more complicated. There are a lot of crazy things about colors. And one of the crazy things is something called color constancy. You all have sunglasses, probably, and many sunglasses are just a neutral gray, but other sunglasses are red or green or, you know, they've got a tint to them. So you would think that when you look at everything through rose-colored glasses, the world would look rosy to you. But in fact, it may look rosy to you for a minute or two, but very, very quickly, most of the colors come back. So somehow or another, your eye is capable of compensating for the fact that you're looking through the world with rose-colored glasses and figuring out what the actual color was there, even though you've got this huge filter in place. And once again, it's your brain is an amazingly powerful processing instrument and figures things out. Another example, which I sometimes mention to classes, has to do with, in my old house, sometimes I would get up in the middle of the night and want to use the facilities, but I didn't really want to wake up. And if I turned on the light in the bathroom, I would really wake up because it would be bright. But there was a heater lamp in the bathroom that, you know, it's like the things that you keep hamburgers under, you know, to keep them warm. And that put out a fairly red light, which was much dimmer. So sometimes if I didn't want to really wake up, I turned those on instead. And you would think that everything in the bathroom would look red to me when I did that, because that was the only form of light there. And indeed they would. But if I stayed in the bathroom for more than a minute or two, all of the colors would come back, even though it was just being illuminated by red light. So there's an amazing constancy to these colors under some circumstances. And then there are other circumstances, which I'm not going to discuss, where colors aren't constant. But even more than that, there are some circumstances in which you can see colors when it's obvious that no colors are present. And this is a device that demonstrates that phenomenon. What are the colors on this wheel over here? Black and white, right? This is not a magic trick. I'm not going to do anything. What color are they now? Well, I see green and red and blue in there. What about you? There are all sorts of colors in that. And yet, it's just black and white. As far as I know, this isn't actually understood why this works. But it obviously does work. I think different people see different colors in it, but most people see some colors. And there's simply nothing there. So there are still mysteries out there for you to solve. Physicists understand the optical system of the eye, but it's up to you, biologists and chemists, to figure out what's going on in the brain. Yes? I can even change the speed. So if you start slow, I'm seeing the band at the outside is red. Everybody agree with that? Anybody agree with it? And then now I'm getting red on the outside, green, and then blue in the center. Yeah, now I'm getting this band is yellow to my eye. Actually, so what color's on the outside? Let me slow it down. So it's reddish on the outside, right? And blue on the center? I haven't actually tried this before, but I'm told that if I reverse this, that the colors are in the opposite order. So, life is full of little mysteries, and this is one of them. Okay, that's really all I wanted to say about eyes. So are there any final questions on the subject? Yes? I'm sorry? You really asked me about what the... Here I am. I've tried to pour out my knowledge. Yes, the damn test ends right at this moment. Okay, guys? Any other questions? Any actual questions that I would want to answer? Yes. No, I think yeah, that's why they put them in order. But you know, it's the one at the bottom. So I think if you're colorblind, they give you their special tests or things you're supposed to know that a normal person wouldn't have to know. I mean, along the lines of this, this is more from your field. Do you know most of the research on genetics? A lot of research on genetics has been done on fruit flies over the years, right? And fruit flies come in all sorts of different variations. My girlfriend, when I was in graduate school, was a fruit fly specialist. The problem is she had to go to the lab 8 hours to keep them from breeding. And that was really bad for our social life. We were walking through Harvard Yard once, and she said to me rather loudly, as some old woman was going by, that I'm sorry, I have to go to the lab. I have to go get some virgins now. But anyway, so there are lots. One of the primary things about fruit flies is that they have different colored eyes, as you probably know, right? They have red eyes, they have green eyes, they have blue eyes. And all of this was laid down by the first biologist to work on fruit flies. And he said, you know, he identified the various traits and showed how you can breed them. Curiously, this biologist was colorblind. So how he knew that they were red eyes or green eyes, he must have been able to tell from the shade of gray somehow or other. And he would just ask what these colors actually corresponded to. Yes? No, I don't. I mean, we were discussing earlier that a lot of colors are due to thin film interference effects, but I've never heard that your eyes have something to do with that. So I don't know what colors. I'm sorry. The only thing I know about that is us brown and black-eyed folks are superior because those eyes work. I'm sorry? Blue eyes aren't great because a lot of light leaks through the blue color. So when your pupil closes down, it doesn't close down as well. I mean, it closes down, but there's still a lot of light leak around the outside. So... other than that, I don't know anything. Is this a real question this time? Okay. Unfortunately, somebody coughed at the crucial moment. Well, this is an immensely complicated topic, but if you shine light onto a metal surface or any surface that has electrons in it, okay, the electrons shake back and forth. And when the electrons shake back and forth, so the light comes in, that causes the electrons to shake back and forth inside the surface. When the electrons shake back and forth inside the surface, that causes them to re-radiate light back out. And that's what actually causes a reflection. We never discussed what actually happens when light hits a surface and reflects. But what actually happens is the electrons inside the surface get shaken up and down by the electric fields of the incoming radio waves, and those electrons when electrons are accelerated, they radiate light, and so they radiate the light back. Okay? So that's a sort of generic explanation of what a reflection is. Now, the electrons may be free electrons, like in a metal. So for instance, with aluminum or stainless steel, it reflects almost anything back. Or they may have electrons, be bound to atoms or bound in curious ways, so that they are frequencies that they prefer to shake up and down at. And this can lead to, when you hit them with the right frequency or the right color, that this can lead to either the light being absorbed or being reflected better. So there's white light hitting my shirt, but what you're actually seeing, you see green coming back. What that means is that the other colors are actually being absorbed by my shirt. Okay, and the one that's not being absorbed is the one that you actually see when it gets radiated back. So that's kind of why subtractive colors in painting works. You put some red paint down and it absorbs everything but red, so the red comes back out, and then you put some blue paint down and it absorbs everything but blue. But when you put the both of them together, you get mud, right? If you're not careful, if you mix too many colors together, you get just mud. Nothing comes back, so it looks black because everything's been absorbed. But this is a tricky subject, and I'll tell you an amusing story. I was working, well, amusing to me anyway, I was working on an accelerator at Livermore for a while. It was an accelerator that was designed to make positrons, antimatter electrons. And there was no funding for this accelerator, so it looked like our experiment was going to have to come to an end. But one of the guys had a sneaky idea, and we actually were able to use this idea to bring money in from the outside to keep on running the accelerator for another year or so. And there's a stone called topaz, as I'm sure you all know. And topaz, I think, is naturally brown. I could be wrong about what its natural color is, okay? And brown topaz is a nice stone. It's a semi-precious stone, but it's nothing special. But it's possible to get blue topaz. And blue topaz, I think it's blue. Okay. Blue topaz is quite a bit more expensive, and it's considered quite a bit more pretty or whatever. That's why it's more expensive. So how do you make blue topaz? It turns out that what you do to make blue topaz is you take brown topaz and put it in front of a particle accelerator for a while. And you bombard it with electrons. The electrons do a couple of things to the stones. They make them somewhat radioactive. And they also change the color properties of the stone by changing the crystal lattice inside of the stone slightly so that it preferentially radiates a different color than brown. And so we were quite literally taking buckets. Somebody would give us a bucket, you know, a real bucket of brown topaz stones. We would put it in front of our accelerator for a couple of days, and then we would give it back to them. And so it really amuses me that, you know, this blue topaz is considered, it's not a diamond, so it's a stone for real people, not fancy people and, you know, like Berkeley people, right? And it always amused me that all of these Berkeley people who are sporting their blue topaz things are sporting necklaces which are somewhat radioactive, made at a nuclear bomb facility. So anyway, they're not very radioactive, and I think what you do is they have a reasonably short half-life. So after you put them in front of the accelerator, you have to leave them in a corner somewhere for a couple of months so that the radioactivity dies down. Other questions? I think there were other problems. It was only partially recovering our funding for the accelerator. Besides, what really happened is that we got screwed by a superconducting magnet manufacturer who promised to deliver a magnet to us for 1 year and took 4 years to deliver it. And by the time he delivered it, the experiment had become uninteresting. So, yes? Do I have a dog? Are there dog hairs? No, I do not have a dog. All right, that question requires some. I have had dogs in my life. I do not currently have any dogs or cats. I have children. Yes, maybe we will be, assuming I actually get somewhere in this lecture. Any other questions? Okay.
Is there a correlation between light and sound? Because for people who see sound translated into color, I thought it's called.
I've heard of this phenomenon, but I don't know anything about it. I mean, people's brains can be miswired in very strange fashions when things go wrong or right, depending on your point of view. Okay. So, I'm still curious why you wanted to know if I had a dog. A German Shepherd yet? You take me for a German Shepherd person? Okay. No, I've never actually owned German Shepherds. The dogs that I did have were when I lived overseas in Afghanistan, and they were partially wolves, because there was a native wolf population which bred pretty freely into the dog population. In fact, a policeman was eaten by a wolf about 5 blocks from my house one night. So, anyway. So the next topic I'm going to discuss is a somewhat illegal topic, because the biology department says that I can't discuss it. But to hell with the biology department. So I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about special relativity. And special relativity is an amazing subject. It's not in any way mathematically complex, but it comes to some incredibly puzzling, but as it turns out, true conclusions. And to begin this discussion of special relativity, what I need to talk about is something called an inertial reference frame. This was probably mentioned to you back in 8B. But it's really going to play, 8A, excuse me, it's really going to make a difference here. So an inertial reference frame is a reference frame which is moving at a constant velocity. What does that mean? As ignoring the rotation of the Earth, for instance, we are in an inertial reference frame. Okay? We may be moving through space, but ignoring all of that, everything's stationary. An airplane, inside of an airplane, is an inertial reference frame. The airplane is moving along in a straight line, hopefully. It's not changing its speed. It's not changing its altitude. It just keeps on going in a straight line. And if you're in a car, which is moving in a straight line, that's an inertial reference frame. And perhaps the most fundamental law of physics is not F equals ma or anything that you've been taught before. It's something called the principle of relativity. And the principle of relativity says something sort of almost stupidly obvious, that the laws of physics, whatever they may be, the laws of physics are the same in all inertial reference frames. Okay, so what do I mean by that? It means that if you do an experiment in one inertial reference frame and then you do it at another inertial reference frame, you're going to get the same result. A very simple example of this is if I'm standing somewhere, okay, and I have a ball, and I drop that ball onto the floor, I can time how long it takes the ball to hit the ground, right? You all know how to do that from 8B, 8A. So that's an experiment. I'm doing it in an inertial reference frame. Now, if this inertial reference frame happens to be in an airplane, I can do that experiment, right? And if I drop a ball inside of an airplane, I will get exactly the same result. It doesn't matter that the airplane might be moving at 600 miles per hour. I'm going to get exactly the same result. Now, this isn't necessarily true if I do this in a non-inertial reference frame. For instance, if I drop a ball inside of an elevator, and so let's say I drop the ball at the instant the elevator starts to move upwards, okay? So I drop it right now, and the elevator just started to move upwards. Would I get the same time? I wouldn't get the same time because the floor of the elevator would be coming up to meet the ball, so it would take less time. Alternately, if I'm in a very tall building and in an elevator in which the cables break so that the elevator is just falling to the ground, if I drop my ball, it's not going to it's going to stay at the same height because I'm falling as well. So that's another non-inertial reference frame. It's a non-inertial reference frame because it's an accelerating reference frame. Another way to say this is if I perform any sort of experiment in an inertial reference frame, I'm always going to get the same result. For instance, I can kind of juggle, not very well, but I can kind of do this. Okay. These are not good juggling balls. Come on. Okay? So that's an experiment. It's an experiment about the dynamics of things, okay? Now, when I'm doing this well, I can do this while walking along. Well, you get the idea, right? I can do this while I'm walking along, because if I walk along at a constant speed, that's also an inertial reference frame, right? Because it doesn't really matter that I'm walking along at a constant speed. I observe the same amount of time for the ball to go up and come down. This is something I can do pretty easily with just one ball. Okay? So in all inertial reference frames, this experiment of juggling balls works. However, if I go to a non-inertial reference frame, like this one, I can't possibly juggle the balls because they go all over the place. All right? So non-inertial reference frames are very, very different from inertial reference frames. By the way, some years ago, I made the flat-out statement that one can't juggle in that chair, and some guy after class came up to me and asked if he could try, and somewhat to my shock, he could. It turned out that he was the captain of the UC Berkeley Juggling Club. So it wasn't really fair. Anyway, so we have this law, the principle of the principle of relativity, that all experiments have to be the same. And that's the first postulate of special relativity. These postulates were kind of laid down by Einstein. So that's number one. And then I'm going to write down the second postulate of the law of special relativity, which is that the speed of light is the same in all reference frames, in all inertial reference frames. Now, this law, this would seem to be, I think it almost follows from the first one, but it's got some special consequences. But when you think about this law, this doesn't sound right. And let me give you an example why it doesn't sound right. This is an experiment that I actually participated in once, involuntarily, I should say. But let's say that you are in a late model Volvo station wagon, and you're about 18 or 19, and you've clearly got too much money and time on your hands. And what you do is you and your friends go out, and your friend leans out the window and throws objects in this direction. And you're young and athletic, so you probably throw the object at, say, 40 miles per hour. And you do this while the car itself is traveling at 40 miles per hour. And these objects that you throw are aimed at various, am I going to succeed in doing this? They're aimed at bicyclists. And in particular, you throw them so these objects hit these people in the face. So at what speed do you think this object is going to hit this person in the face? Say the bicycle is, let's say this actually occurs while you're going uphill, so the bicyclist is not moving very fast. So what speed? 80 miles per hour, right? They throw it at 40, but they're standing on something which is moving at 40. So if we define this is V, and this is u, then the total velocity is going to be u plus v. And this is more or less how I got hit in the head by a persimmon at 80 miles an hour. So this makes sense. But now let's go to a slightly more sophisticated setup where we have a rocket. And in the rocket, there's a laser. And the laser shoots light out. And we know that it shoots light out at a speed which is equal to the speed of light, which is given this name C. And the rocket ship itself is moving at some velocity U. So if the laser is shooting stuff out at a speed that's equal to C, and the laser is mounted on a rocket which is moving at a velocity u, at what speed should this light be moving? Well, it will actually be moving at c, but what would this analogy over here tell you? It should be moving at c plus u. And yet it's not. the light that comes out of the laser would be observed by somebody that was on the ground over here to be moving at the velocity of c. So velocities appear to add in our everyday experience. This is called the Galilean addition of velocities. But Einstein and others realized that when you have light involved, the velocities do not add. And that's really, really puzzling. And that's the beginning of a trip, if you will, and it is almost an acid trip, into special relativity. Trying to explain how this could be come about. Why is it that additive velocities, which ought to be additive, are not additive? And that's what I'm going to spend a couple of days on. But for various reasons, which I'll get into next week, I actually need to do student evaluations at this point. So I'm going to spend the rest of this class doing student evaluations, if you don't mind. Let's see, could you take this and do the aisle that's all the way over on the other side? And, no, do the one that's all the way on the other side. And could you take this and do these guys? So as I'm sure you guys are expert at these things by now. You know that I don't see them until after I've assigned the grades. I do read them, and I try and understand and improve what I'm doing on the basis of what I get back as feedback. Unfortunately, the feedback that I get back is often somewhat contradictory. And you also know that to some extent, what is helpful to me is comments, not just the numerical rating. I don't learn anything from the numerical rating. But if you want to take revenge on me, you can give me a poor numerical rating because that has a minor effect on my salary. But you know, all know by now that I really need a pet and I can't afford one. So, please don't give me a bad rating because... all that. Anyway, does everybody have a copy of the evaluation forms? Well, you can vote early and often if you're going to write them well. And I need somebody to volunteer, please, to take them back to the department office, which is just on the third floor of this building. So, is there anybody willing to volunteer to take them back? Okay, do you know where to go? It's just straight up from here. Okay, I'm really not supposed to hang out during this process. So I will leave the envelope into which they all go. And I'll see you on next Monday.